There's a solitary, humble wooden structure on a windswept hill in rural New England. To open the door is to engage our minds, our hearts, and our imaginations. In this place, preachers and professors, past and present, come alive as they walk the aisle, ascend the pulpit stairs, and teach. From theology, from history, and from the Word of God. Welcome to the Saybrook Meeting House, an audio production of Saybrook Ministries.
On the Character of God. Beloved brother, the task which you assign me, though arduous, is inviting. I approach it with trembling. Yet, as I approach, I feel a threefold pleasure, arising first from the disposition you show in requesting me to write on such a subject, secondly, from the hope that a divine blessing will attend my humble efforts, and thirdly, from the prospect of fixing my thoughts on a theme which I hope ever to contemplate with new delight. With all the friendly anxieties occasioned by your last letter, I had the pleasure to observe what a serious desire you manifest to examine the fundamental points of Christianity. In view of what I have written, you are so candid as to allow that the Bible contains intelligible and full instruction respecting the great things of religion, and that we must be supposed capable of discovering the truth. You have selected the subject which, of all subjects, is the most essential. Your great difficulty, you say, respects the character of God. Complete satisfaction on this point, you think, would extend to all other points. But here your mind is unsettled. Though you have heard much and read much concerning God, you are yet so unhappy as to be without any clear and determinate ideas of his character. In particular, you tell me that the character which Calvinists ascribe to the Supreme Being is clothed with terror. Scarcely any feature of it appears amiable. Still, you are not able to rest in any other description of God, and you wish me to write on the subject with that freedom which I have ever used and which you kindly receive as a proof of brotherly affection. I comply with your request. My object is not to treat at large this astonishing subject, but only to suggest a few leading hints to aid your own meditations. The perfection of God can never be grasped by a limited understanding. Only a little portion of him is known, and that we know because he has unveiled it. The great question is, what instruction hath God given us respecting himself? What is the moral character which we are taught to ascribe to the Supreme Being? The heaven-taught John furnishes this brief answer, God is love. These three words contain more information concerning God than all the books of heathen philosophy. Love constitutes the moral essence and glory of deity. Without love or goodness, his natural perfections would never render him amiable. Infinite knowledge and power, under the control of malevolence, would constitute an inconceivably hateful character. Under such influence, knowledge would plot, and power would perpetrate unbounded mischief. But God is love. All his natural perfections are under the influence of the most enlightened and extensive benevolence. His character is therefore both venerable and lovely. It results from the absolute perfection of God that he from eternity adopted the most excellent plan of operation. All possible schemes were viewed by the infinite mind of Jehovah before he began to create. Perfect goodness chose the best. To say that God could have chosen a better system is to charge him with imperfection. If there could have been a better system than that which God eternally chose, there must have been either a defect in his understanding, in not discerning it, or a fault in his heart in not adopting it. When the system eternally chosen is declared to be absolutely the best, you must well consider with what an extensive view it is declared. It is not meant that every part of the created system, considered separately, or the whole, considered for any limited duration, is the best that divine perfection could have produced. All parts of the system must be considered in connection, and the whole as extending to unlimited duration. It was in this view the only wise God chose it. In this view, we pronounce it absolutely the best. You must consider also that when we pronounce the system which God has adopted the best, we do it from unreserved confidence in his infinite wisdom and goodness. As we are totally unable to comprehend all the parts which compose the system, and still more unable to extend our views to the unlimited duration of the whole, it would be the greatest arrogance in us to pronounce any sentence upon it except that which is dictated by full confidence in eternal wisdom. By expressing our unwavering belief, yea, our happy certainty, that the scheme which God has chosen is the best possible, we do not profess to be wise above what is written, nor undertake to judge of that which is above our reach. Such belief is founded wholly on the absolute perfection of Him, of whom, and through whom, and to whom are all things, and on that infallible word which assures us his work is perfect. If I rest upon the wisdom or upon the truth of God, I must conclude that the great scheme of the universe is stamped with perfection, that nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it, and that its all-wise author has never found and will never find any occasion for the least amendment. This sentiment, which is intimately connected with the consideration of the divine character, harmonizes with reason and with revelation. It favors the most exalted piety by inculcating an implicit belief that God has acted wisely in a case where we are totally incapable of comprehending what he has done. This sentiment is also most comforting to us. It tends to dissipate all the gloom with which the mind is overspread by viewing the disorders in the natural and moral worlds. What can be more animating and delightful than the cordial belief that perfect goodness and wisdom inhabit the eternal throne? Such a belief is a broad basis for the most profound and cheerful submission, for inward peace which nothing can interrupt, and for the purest, sublimest joy. But I cannot yet leave this great subject, the foundation of all divine truth and of all moral harmony and beauty. Although in many respects clouds and darkness are round about the character of God, the light of the knowledge of his glory shines in the gospel of Christ. Yea, illuminated by that gospel, we see that it shines in the dispensations of providence. Providence, as well as revelation, proclaims this precious truth, with which we begin, that God is love. The Calvinistic scheme, which, in your view, clothes God with the most unamiable character, embraces this truth. It teaches that all God's moral attributes are comprised in love, and that his administration is a diversified and endless display of it. His goodness is over all his works. He looks with a benevolent eye upon all sensitive beings, from the highest archangel to the smallest insect. He regards the falling of a sparrow and the cry of young ravens, as well as the prayers of his people and the praise of angels. He wishes well to the universe. But holy beings are the objects not only of his benevolence, but of his complacency and delight. The Lord loveth the righteous and taketh pleasure in them that fear him. He not only desires their welfare, but approves their character. His goodness necessarily inclines him to love goodness in his creatures. The love of God operates in the way of grace to sinners. When he promised to display his glorious goodness to Moses, this was represented as a capital part of that display. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy to whom I will show mercy. Scripture considers the salvation of sinners as the work of divine love. I might add that the punishment of sinners arises from the same principle. But on this topic, I only request you for the present to peruse the 136th Psalm, which professedly and in the most affecting manner celebrates the goodness and mercy of God, and see how large a portion of it is occupied in rehearsing his judgments upon the wicked. All the operations of God are calculated to promote his glory and the great interests of the universe. His glory, though for a time concealed from the eyes of mortals, will finally shine forth, and its luster will be the brighter for its temporary obscurity. The highest felicity of the intelligent creation is likewise included in the divine scheme. It is an object so dear to the heart of God that he has unalterably associated it with his own glory. Such I take to be the leading sentiment of Calvinism respecting God. The objections against it, which have been urged with singular zeal, and which you admit have made a deep impression on your mind, shall now be considered. They are subtle and specious, but not solid. I discuss them the more readily, because I apprehend that the very things which are objected against God will, on candid inquiry, appear greatly to his honor. Your first objection against the Calvinistic doctrine of God is that it represents him as making his own glory and blessedness, rather than the happiness of his creatures, his chief, ultimate end. This representation, it is said, degrades the character of God by ascribing to him those selfish feelings which are always accounted a meanness in mankind, and robs him of the honor of that benevolence which primarily seeks the good of others. I need not inform you, my brother, that the sentiment against which this objection is urged is explicitly asserted in the Scriptures. The Lord made all things for himself. Of him, and through him, and to him are all things. For his pleasure they are, and were created. I acknowledge that a man's having a supreme regard to his own interest or honor is the greatest blemish. But must the Lord of all be placed upon a level with man in point of personal worthiness? Because it is criminal presumption in man to set himself on the throne, is it therefore presumption in God? Is it arrogance for Jehovah to say, I am God, and there is none else? Must the regard which he entertains toward his own infinite perfection be measured by the regard which a worm ought to have toward himself? Candidly examine this subject. Why do we blame a man for thinking highly of himself? Because he has not personal merit to render such thoughts suitable. We cannot blame a person for esteeming himself according to his real worth. It is when his estimation of himself rises above the measure of his own excellence that we stigmatize it. But when God loves himself supremely, Does he love himself above the measure of his own worthiness? Is not his excellence infinitely superior to all created excellence? And must he cease to regard it accordingly, because it is his? Say, my brother, does not the infinite excellence of the Creator render it suitable that he should love himself above all the creation and supremely regard his own glory and blessedness? If he should not, he would be partial and unjust. He would deny himself. To say it is a fault in God to make himself the object of supreme regard and his own glory the end of all his works is implicitly to say that divine perfection does not deserve supreme regard, and that divine glory is less worthy to be sought than some other end. Were this true, God could not with propriety command us to love him with all the heart and make his glory our chief end. But even among the framers of the objection, whoever dared to make this command a topic of complaint? Yet this command, as they must see, is sure evidence that God is the object of his own supreme love, and his own glory the end of all his works. There is one more consideration which deserves particular notice. God's making his own glory and happiness his chief end is so far from being to the disadvantage of his creatures that the good of the universe is comprised in it. The glory of God, my brother, is the display of his benevolence. His happiness consists in the efficacious operation of his love. It is the happiness of an infinite benefactor. By promoting his own glory and blessedness, he secures the highest felicity of the intelligent system. He created angels and men and all other objects for the purpose of promoting the general good. As far as they eventually do this, they display the glory of God's love and afford pleasure to his heart. Thus his glory and blessedness include the general welfare. On the contrary, if God should make his own glory a secondary object, and for any consideration should violate his own purity, wisdom, veracity, or righteousness, in short, if he should dishonor his own character as supreme governor of the universe, he would manifestly do the greatest injury to his creatures. Now why should that which at once displays the amiableness of God and secures the highest interests of the universe be to mortals an occasion of murmuring? Why should we object against our Maker for entertaining and expressing that supreme regard for himself, to surrender which would be most flagrantly to violate the first principle of impartial justice, to descend from his throne, to cease to be God, and would thus destroy the only basis of union and felicity among rational creatures? And let me ask, dear brother, why should Calvinism be thought to cool the ardor or banish the delights of piety by assigning to God the highest place in the universe, by declaring that all creatures, in comparison with him, are as a drop in the bucket and as the small dust of the balance, and by insisting that he regards himself and that we ought to regard him according to the place he holds in the great system of being? The second objection you state against the character which Calvinism ascribes to God is the gloomy doctrine of his eternal decrees. But why is this a gloomy doctrine? Was it not suitable that God, in the exercise of unlimited knowledge and benevolence, should eternally fix the plan of his own operations and the whole course of events? The denial of this must spring from the want of confidence in divine perfection. The question is, shall the circumstances of creation, the events of providence, and the condition of creatures be referred to the determination of God, or to the determination of creatures, or to the determination of chance, that is, left without any determination. The last can have no sober advocate. The great determination, then, must lie between God and his creatures. To whom can it be most safely referred? Who is the best qualified? All must answer alike. It is most desirable that all things should be determined by him, who is infinitely wise and good, and whose determination must, therefore, be right. Another question is whether it appear best that the divine determination take place in eternity or in some period of time. In eternity must be considered the most consistent answer, unless it may be supposed that time will afford some new advantage for a proper determination. But what new advantage can time afford? If any be possible, it must consist in more clear and perfect knowledge or in a better disposition. To suppose God capable of either is to dishonor his immutable perfection. One more question remains. Is it desirable that the eternal purpose of God be absolute and unalterable? If it were possible that the divine purpose should need or admit any amendment, every good man would feel an objection against its being absolute and unchangeable. But who can wish the purpose of infinite wisdom and infinite love to be changeable? If, my dear brother, you would have a clear and comfortable view of this doctrine, you must detach from it all the false appendages with which the blindness of prejudice and the malignity of sin have surrounded it. You must remove the misrepresentations by which its cunning adversaries have deformed and disgraced it. You must cure the disease of the jaundiced eye. Then you will view the divine decrees not as the frightful instruments with which a cruel despot injures and destroys his harmless subjects, but as the result of infallible wisdom, the dictates of unbounded benevolence. I contemplate the divine decrees, which pride and guilt have dressed in horror, as the eternal operations of Jehovah's perfections. If I admire his perfections, I must admire those eternal perfections which his wisdom and love adopted and which his power will accomplish. Your third objection is that Calvinism represents God as an arbitrary, vindictive being and holds the frightful doctrine of endless punishment. If arbitrary means acting without reason, we deny that God is arbitrary. We hold that he never entertained a single design and never performs a single action without such reasons as fully justify it in the view of his own wisdom and in the view of all qualified judges. Nor do we ever apply the term vindictive to God as implying that he has a disposition to punish for the sake of punishing, or to be pleased with the misery of his creatures. The Lord hath no pleasure in the death even of the wicked. He would never inflict punishment were it not necessary for the general good. His heart is as benevolent when he punishes as when he blesses, when he frowns as when he smiles. He is as good in the desolating hurricane as in the cooling zephyr, in the furious storm as in the refreshing shower, in the far-sweeping inundation as in the gently flowing rivulet. By sensations of pain as well as of pleasure, by punishment as well as by reward, he seeks the welfare of his kingdom. Sin, my brother, is a great evil. If sin should be successful and triumphant, the throne of God would be subverted, his law trampled upon, his honor laid in the dust, and all order, virtue, and happiness annihilated. If the ultimate design of sin should be accomplished, there would nowhere appear the least trace of moral beauty or joy. The good of the world depends on the strength of opposition which is maintained against the cause of sin. If God should cease to oppose and punish sin, he would cease to be a good ruler. Should he stand an inactive spectator of the rising influence and far-spreading mischief of iniquity, he would resign all title to our love and reverence. He would resemble a king who, from a spurious benevolence, from indolence or depravity, should let theft and murder prevail, without taking any effectual measures to put a stop to them and save his kingdom from ruin. We venerate God as the moral governor of the world, the guardian of being in general. It belongs to him to seek the highest welfare of the whole. In human governments, the general good is frequently inconsistent with the happiness of some individuals. To make a sacrifice of such individuals, suppose of traitors and murderers, in order to counteract the hurtful influences of their example and secure from injury the great interests of society, is never supposed to detract from the benevolence of government. Capacity and inclination to punish disorder in a state is never thought to render an earthly prince less lovely in the eyes of his loyal subjects. That temper of mind, on the contrary, which should induce him to connive at disorder, however it might go under the name of benevolence, would by all the friends of good government be accounted injustice to the public. And why should it be thought to detract from the honor of God that in order to promote the holiness and happiness of his everlasting kingdom, he punishes unrelenting sinners? But I will not enlarge. The subject is ably treated by several writers, particularly Edwards, in his reply to Chauncey, which you may consult at your leisure. I refer you above all to the Scriptures. There, my brother, you will learn that vengeance is the prerogative of God, and that the endless punishment of the wicked is one way in which he is determined to display his excellencies, to vindicate the honor of his violated law, and to promote the most valuable interests of the universe. Your fourth objection arises from the doctrine of atonement. It is the objection of Socinus. The doctrine seems inconsistent with the natural benignity and placability of God. It paints him as being merciless and inexorable until full satisfaction is made to him for the breach of his laws and a full price paid for his mercy. I rejoice in this opportunity to declare that I regard these distortions of evangelical truth as originating in the pitiful weakness and dishonesty of God's enemies. Calvinism never considers the atonement as the cause of divine love, but maintains that divine love is the sole cause of human salvation, and of the atonement as the only suitable medium of mercy to sinners, according to that inspired declaration, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. There was sufficient love in the heart of God to save sinners without the death of Christ, had it been consistent with righteousness. The necessity of an atonement does not arise from the want of benevolence in God. The atonement was appointed by the most extensive benevolence. God is disposed to pardon and save sinners, but in doing this, he will not neglect the honor of his throne nor the interests of the moral system. If salvation is bestowed on sinners, infinite benevolence requires that it should be done in such a way as will prevent the direful effects of sin. The atonement is that way. It is the expedient of divine wisdom to counteract the influence and avert the pernicious consequences of human transgression. Without such an expedient, that influence must have been counteracted by the personal suffering of transgressors. Through the atonement, God can grant remission without giving up his authority or holding out a public license to commit sin. Through that medium, the fullness of divine grace can safely flow out to penitent offenders. While mercy triumphs, it is not at the expense of Jehovah's character or the general good. On the contrary, if God should forgive sin without any atonement, it would be a virtual acknowledgement that he had enacted a law so rigorous that it ought to be repealed, and issued threatenings which he felt himself obliged to retract. Such a proceeding, my brother, while exactly agreeable to the Socinian scheme, would be so great a blemish in God as would destroy the bliss of heaven. Yes, I shudder at the thought. It would be such a treacherous desertion of his office as ruler and guardian of the universe, and give such a stamp of imperfection to his character as would render it unfit to adore him and even justify open rebellion. The last objection, which you specify, is that many are ready to say they cannot feel a perfect veneration and love for such a character as Calvinism ascribes to God. I allow the fact, my brother, yet nothing results from it unfavorable to Calvinism. It is possible the persons alluded to have such a temper of mind as indisposes them to love and venerate God in his true character. Through the influence of a depraved heart, the Holy One of Israel may be an object of dislike and aversion. The God whom the Bible reveals is by no means pleasing to the wicked. The sight of him fills them with dismay. This we esteem no small part of his purity and glory. What agreement hath light with darkness? If God's character is infinitely benevolent, it must be repugnant to the feelings of the selfish. If holy, to the feelings of the impure. If he is a just judge, his face must be dreadful to guilt. It is the glory of Calvinism that it does not administer soporific poison to the consciences of men, that it does not give peace to the wicked by concealing or discoloring the character of Jehovah, that it does not seduce and ruin the souls of men by inculcating such a notion of God as they can easily associate with their crimes. It is the glory of Calvinism that it faithfully describes that God, whose holy administration is an unwelcome reproof, disturbance, and alarm to impenitent transgressors, and excites the enmity of the carnal mind. But it has this glory too, that its God is venerated and loved by all the holy, in whose view he is clothed with infinite excellence. Such, my brother, is the spirit of genuine Calvinism. I glory in being its professed and conscientious advocate, not because I value it as the ensign of a party, but because in my view it contains the substance of sacred truth and echoes the voice of God. Such, as I have imperfectly described, is the character it has taught me to ascribe to the great being of beings. How attractive, how venerable, how glorious. This, then, is the sum. If you ask, what is God? I answer, God is love. If you ask, what prompted his eternal decrees? I answer, love. If you ask, what is the great motive of all his operations? My answer is, love. If you ask, what object he aims at in the great variety of natural and moral evil, which exists under his all-directing providence, I answer, the object of perfect benevolence. He means it for good. Love is the sum of Jehovah's excellence, the ornament, the crown, the glory of his character. In the bosom of divine love originated all created existence and the grand system of the universe. Divine love shines forth in the whole series of providential dispensations. Love exceedingly abounds in redemption. Its almighty energy founded, has protected, and will enlarge and exalt the kingdom of Christ. Divine love will be inexpressibly admired and glorified at the judgment day. The clear sight of it will at that awful, decisive period fill the saints not only with resignation, but with transports of serenest joy. And the fruition of it will create an eternal heaven in their souls. That infinite love, which is the moral glory of deity, has everything to allure our affection, to gain our confidence, to raise our adoration and praise. It sweetly attracts us by its most amiable mildness, while it awes us by its superlative majesty. It humbles us by its transcendent dignity, yet exalts us by its engaging condescension. With warm affections for your soul, I beseech you, my beloved brother, to be reconciled to God, and from this moment, let it be your blessed employment to understand and imitate his love. A letter on the character of God, printed and published in the Calvinistic Magazine, February 1830.
Thank you for joining us this week at the Saybrook Meeting House. We hope you've been blessed by today's podcast. Saybrook Ministries' mission is to provide didactic and devotional content from the Christian faith delivered to the saints, recovered and refined by the Protestant Reformation. Be sure to visit saybrookministries.org, as well as our Facebook and Twitter pages, for continually updated Christian content designed to inspire and invigorate our imagination and intellect. Join us next week for another journey to the Saybrook Meeting House. Until then, may God bless you.